You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Discussions of climate change in this country tend to focus on what the individual can do to help or what businesses are not doing and whether the government should intervene. But the impact of climate change on underdeveloped and developing countries is rarely addressed. In his latest book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Chaos, Christian Parenti links climate change to the poverty and violence that's endemic in these countries. And not only does this catastrophic convergence cause their people to suffer, but it also threatens everyone globally. Mr. Parenti is an investigative journalist and contributing editor at The Nation. His book is published by Nation Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Could you define what you're calling Tropic of Chaos?
Well, I'm referring to what some people call the Global South or the Third World, that belt of states between the Tropic of Capricorn and the Tropic of Cancer, where people live with a less margin of error economically than in developed countries. So when a drought and flood hit, there's greater suffering. And it's also been the front lines of other processes, particularly the Cold War's proxy fights happened in those places.
Are they more affected by climate change? I'm just talking about on a physical level, or is it because of their circumstances that they're more affected?
I think that it is that they're not more affected because of their latitudes.
Like La Nina and El Nino,
yeah.
We talk about them in this country, but they affect that part of the world as well?
Yeah, I mean, the poles are greatly affected. The equatorial regions are greatly affected. But then, you know, this year we're seeing really intense weather in the mid-latitudes as well. But they are definitely more vulnerable socially because economically people live closer to natural systems.
And their political systems are generally unstable.
This is true. This is one of the unfortunate legacies of the Cold War in part, and also I think economic restructuring to some extent has undermined the capacity of states to address climate change and meet people's needs.
One of the countries that you discuss is Kenya. What are normal weather patterns for Kenya like?
Well, Kenya has quite variegated weather patterns locally, but to the extent you can generalize, there's generally two rainy seasons governed by the Intertropical Convergence Zone, which is a weather system that's pulled north and south with the sun between the Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn. And that delivers, in the best of times, two dependable rainy seasons around which Kenyan farmers plant and, you know, depend for not just watering their fields, but also counting on dry times for drying the corn. And those are increasingly out of sync. And I opened the book in Kenya, not with a farmer, but with a group of pastoralists in the Turkana region of the Rift Valley. And there's a man named Ekeru Lorimon who has been killed the day before in a cattle raid. And I try and ask why this has happened. What are the forces that have led to this man's death?
Well, some years ago, I talked with a Nobel Prize winner who said that part of the problem in Kenya is just that it had been denuded of trees, and she had instituted a program of putting trees back into the countries to eliminate some of these weather problems, and had been faced with a lot of political opposition.
Right. This is Wangari Maathai,
yeah.
I assume. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, Kenya has legendarily corrupt government, and it's also been subject to economic liberalization. And in the process of the two, the state has retreated from trying to support poor farmers and pastoralists. So in the case of these pastoralists in the Turkana region, they're crowding around the few water holes that they have. And the region is also, the entire region, not just Kenya, is gripped by a very bad drought that's getting critical right now.
Now, how can it have heavy rainfall and drought all at the same time?
This is the general pattern. I mean, as the atmosphere heats up, it generally holds more water, and there's actually more precipitation. And it was interesting. Everybody in Kenya thought the place was getting drier. And then when I spoke to the meteorologists there, they looked at the chart and says, yeah, actually, we're getting more rainfall. But the thing, it comes all at once. It doesn't come during the rainy seasons. And so this drought is punctuated by really sudden and violent problematic flooding.
So it gets a lot of water, and then everything dries out.
Right.
And that's actually worse than if they just got a little bit of rain here, a little bit of rain
right,
there.
Right, right.
And the
water
man you
runs
mentioned,
off.
And the man you mentioned earlier, Ikaru Loriman, you say was, in a sense, killed by climate change.
That's what I'm arguing. I mean, he was in the most immediate sense, he was killed by a person or some people from a neighboring tribe, the Pequot, who had came to steal his cattle. But then I asked, well, why were they so close to the Pequot? And it was because there were a lack of other wells further away.
But there had been a long history of of conflict between these two groups.
So I'm not saying, I'm never, throughout the book, I'm never arguing that climate change is the sole cause of violence, but that it's an exacerbating cause of pre-existing problems, and it's growing more intense.
Well, this is also an area near the Ugandan border, and Uganda has its own problems, including a couple of insurgencies. Mm-hmm. Are there more firearms in the area as well?
Yeah, that history plays into it. Uganda, when Idi Amin fell from power, Uganda became a failed state momentarily. Some armories on the border with Kenya were looted, and that's when the first wave of AK-47s really entered Kenya. Now, of course, Somalia is nearby. That's a failed state. There's been a war on and off in South Sudan. So the region is awash in weaponry. So that's another contributing factor to why Ikaru Loriman died.
So we have these failed states and semi-failed states. Congo is nearby as well, and we have wars going on in many of these countries. Are the failed states in any way related to climate change, or does the climate change just cause more problems because we're talking about failed states and semi-failed states?
Well, I think previously, for example, the failure of Somalia or the collapse of Democratic Republic of Congo, that's not caused by climate change. But now there is a large group of fragile states that are being threatened by climate change, and I think it's now becoming a contributing factor. So in Northwest Kenya, you have essentially intercommunal warfare. This cattle raiding has gone from being crime into actual warfare between communities. The Kenyan police go in, they're paramilitary, they have helicopters. When the cattle raiders don't get cattle, sometimes they go after buses. And it's a very, very violent situation there that, you know, it's just one region of Kenya, but up there, you know, there's definitely something like relative state failure going on.
Sudan also had problems as a result of tensions between people with cattle and farmers.
Right. And they used to have this symbiotic relationship whereby the pastoralists would graze on the fields after they had been harvested and in the process fertilize the fields. But when the rains got out of sync, that their migrations changed and they came into direct conflict with farmers, and that was a contributing factor to what happened in Darfur.
My guest is Christian Parenti. His latest book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, it's published by Nation Books. You talk about a 2-degree centigrade threshold climate scientists have said is a tipping point. What will happen to weather patterns if global temperature rises above that threshold?
Well, I mean, we can't say for sure, but what happens is it becomes more erratic and more violent, and the kind of crazy weather we're seeing this summer is expected to become the norm. And the other dangerous thing is that the process of climate change, the process of global warming, can become self-fueling. So, for example, one of the big risks is if the permafrost in the Arctic melts, which is the result of global warming, it will release methane, which will then feed back and compound the problem of global warming. So that's one of the real dangers beyond 2 degrees is these positive feedback loops that are actually quite negative can be set off.
Well, in Kenya, there's Kilimanjaro, isn't there? And haven't we heard that there are really no snows of Kilimanjaro anymore?
Yeah, the Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya are both losing their glaciers, and that's affecting people downstream who are, you know, therefore more dependent on the rains that aren't coming. And one of the places I visited in Kenya was out in the desert, basically, a Somali community. And they hadn't had rain for, I think it was 2 years, maybe now it's 3 years. And their only lifeline was the Tana River, which is fed by these declining glaciers and snowpacks in Mount Kenya.
How can there be no rain in 3 years?
It's a serious crisis. I mean, it's...
They haven't been rained there before.
It was a semi-arid region where they would have a rainy season, maybe even two. I forget the exact nature of that area. But it would be a light rainy season, and it was enough. It was hard to farm there, but they're pastoralists. There was enough rain for there to be shrubs for goats to live on. And now it's just the trees, the acacia trees, look like driftwood. You know, they're completely desiccated. And so people depend on international aid, a little bit of farming around the Tana River, and, in many cases, violence.
Well, I mentioned the 2 degrees centigrade threshold. What about carbon dioxide? Is there a tipping point threshold there as well?
Yeah, scientists believe that after 350 parts per million, we enter a danger zone. And there's some debate on that. The most European governments in the U.S. like to think that 450 parts per million is as far as you can go. We're now at 390 parts per million of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. But a lot of climate scientists, such as James Hansen of NASA, think that after 350 parts per million, we enter this danger zone where these positive feedback loops can be set off and that climate change or global warming can become self-compounding. So we're in the danger zone, which is why we need to really think about both adaptation and mitigation, which is cutting these emissions.
So we have the 2 degree centigrade threshold being surpassed, the carbon dioxide threshold being passed, and then what happens?
Well, you're asking me to predict the future, and I mean, I don't really know. We don't know ultimately what happens.
Well, I asked Michelle Bachmann. She said no problem.
Yeah. Well, she's wrong. I'll go that far. Bad things can happen. And I mean, one wing of the U.S. government that's taking this seriously is the Pentagon. And they project that places like, India can handle these changes up until about 2030. Then after that, if it's business as usual, who knows? So who knows? What happens is that things like the Black Sea drought that happened last year that caused Russia to cut off its grain exports, which caused wheat to almost double in price, which was then a contributing factor in the Arab Spring, which at first was very positive. It's about democratization. But let's remember, there's also a couple of wars associated with that.
So the Pentagon is looking at these things because they see this as a potential cause of conflict.
Correct.
And involving us or just people in the various regions?
Their reports generally see this as leading not to interstate conflict but to civil war, banditry, social breakdown. But they realize that the armed services are going to be called upon to engage, intervene, and help manage this crisis. And so that's what they're projecting. And, I mean, they don't, make policy. They execute policy, and they're just, projecting what's going to happen. And they see that basically counterinsurgency is going to remain front and center in their military policy.
In fact, you said counterinsurgency is worse in some ways than regular warfare.
Strangely, yes. What counterinsurgency does, because the civilian society is the object, in counterinsurgency you seek not to control terrain but to control the population. So that can actually have damaging effects and lead to social disintegration. And the reasons are that counterinsurgency frequently involves creating proxy forces, flooding the society with small arms. And once the war is over, all of those methods of smuggling, these private proxy forces, paramilitaries, they're hard to contain again, put back in the bottle. And you see that there's a greater level of what sociologists call anomie and, crime that follows counterinsurgency. And, interestingly, in conventional warfare, not that I'm advocating conventional warfare or anything, but like during the Blitz in London, people came together. There was an increase in social solidarity. And that is not the case with civil wars, internal conflicts, in which counterinsurgency is a central feature.
Because people are forced to leave their homes. They wind up in refugee camps and mm-hmm. all sorts of other problems ensue.
Yeah.
Christian Parenti has written for Fortune, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, Playboy, Mother Jones, the London Review of Books. He's a contributing editor at The Nation and a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute, a visiting scholar at City University next year at Brooklyn College.
That's right.
And his latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, published by Nation Books. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Christian Parenti, whose latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. The region you detail in your book is part of a larger expanse that you refer to as the Global South. What differentiates the Global South from the Global North?
Well, in many ways, it's the history of colonialism. I mean, Europe and the countries that are now the OECD countries colonized and established many of the states that are now in the Global South, in Latin America, Africa, and parts of Asia. So there was a relationship of exploitation for many years between the Global North and the Global South. And I mean, to this day, economic policy is developed primarily in the Global North and implemented upon the Global South frequently.
Often the old colonial power still is a major force in the former colony.
Correct.
But since the Global North also tends to be more industrialized, can it be blamed for creating some of the polluting problems?
Yes. I mean, that's something I don't actually get into in the book, but that's very much the case. I mean, historically, the Industrial Revolution is what caused this loading of CO2 into the atmosphere from 280 parts per million before the Industrial Revolution to, as I said, 390 parts now. And yeah, England and the U.S. and the other industrial powers are responsible for that historical deposit of CO2 in the atmosphere.
What effect did the Cold War have on the region?
The Cold War very much weakened the states of the Global South because many of them became the front lines in these proxy fights between the capitalist camp and the socialist camp. I mean, the story of Somalia's collapse is an example of that. The Cubans were there. Ethiopia and Somalia were both socialist states. The Cubans and Soviets were helping them out. And then the dictator of Somalia, Said Barre, launched this ethnic war to reclaim the Ogaden region, which is a Somali-populated region of Ethiopia. Out of that war, then he switched sides, and the Carter administration started supporting him. And so out of this local ethnic conflict, you know, the superpowers poured in resources, and it ended with the Somali army disintegrating and turning on Said Barre in January 1991, and we get, like, the first modern failed state. So that's kind of an extreme example of what the Cold War did to the Global South.
Well, in the past, there was the Soviet Union and China were arming some of the insurgent groups, and the United mm-hmm. States was supporting the people in power. Now we see a different kind of situation. China has become a major economic factor in Africa, especially mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. some degree in South America as well. Mm-hmm. Is this a new kind of colonialism?
Well, I mean, yes, you could say perhaps, but that's something I don't really deal with in the book. But China is also developing Africa and Latin America. I mean, that's part of how they're getting their advantage over Western firms is that they don't lend money to potentially corrupt governments. They go in and they build the roads, they build the dams. So there's actually a lot of local development that goes along with the Chinese footprint in a place like Africa.
You argue that the drug trade in Afghanistan is a result of climate change, the growing of poppies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this book, it's not a result just of climate change, but this book sort of developed out of reporting I was doing in Afghanistan on the poppy trade, which is the source for heroin. And farmers would explain why they were doing this. I'd ask them, why are you growing this illegal crop that the government and its NATO allies want to destroy? And one element of their answer was always the drought, which I at the time didn't really realize there was a drought. And each time I would do stories on poppy, they would always refer to the drought. And I started thinking, okay, here's a connection between climate change and violence. And sure enough, Afghanistan has suffered the worst drought in living memory over the last 10 years. And we have a situation where the Afghan government and the NATO forces are trying to eradicate poppy, or at least that's their rhetoric. The Taliban, on the other hand, say, we will defend the farmer's right to grow poppy.
They even engage in the poppy trade.
This is true. The poppy uses one-fifth the water that wheat uses. So for many of these farmers, it's simply not feasible to grow legal crops and survive. They have to grow the illegal crop, and there's one side in the conflict that says, we will protect you. So along with all of the religious ideology, along with the ethnic nationalism of the Pashtun who support the Taliban in the south, all these factors that provide young recruits to the Taliban, there's another material thing linked to this climate crisis, which is that poppy is the only way many of these people can survive.
The United States must be aware of that. Is there something that we can do to turn things around, to convince farmers to grow something else? Can we help them to grow something else?
There are programs, but unless the climatological issues dealt with, wheat and apricots don't really work. And, you know, in the beginning of the U.S. occupation, poppy was not an issue. The NATO forces did not go after it. But it was domestic pressure from elements in the GOP that put that front and center. And so there isn't a well-thought-out response to the drug problem in Afghanistan, the drug trade, and its link to climate change. But, I mean, that's indicative of many aspects of the Afghan war not well thought out.
Well, even some of the more idealistic programs have boomeranged, haven't they? The Green Revolution, for example. Neoliberalism.
Yeah. The Green Revolution, I deal with that in India, where you have a Maoist insurgency that has been going since 1969. It's known as the Naxalites, named for the province it came from. And for a long time, the Naxals were locked up in the northeast corner of India. But India also has suffered years and years of drought in this decade. And one can see the progression of the Naxalites south down the eastern coast of India in districts where there are drought. And so I went to these places to see what was going on. And it's never as simple as drought causes people to join the guerrillas. But drought causes them to go into debt because the government since 1991 has pulled back its support for small farmers. Because of the Green Revolution, which was originally designed with the best of intentions to boost food production, but it relied on chemical inputs, the farmers use those Green Revolution methods to grow cotton now, which is very water dependent. And so they, not being able to get subsidized loans and aid from the government, they borrow money from moneylenders. They then lose their land. And as a result, you have this rash of suicides in places like Andhra Pradesh, but you also have political homicide, people joining the guerrillas in these drought-stricken districts.
Weren't farmers also encouraged to grow cotton because they weren't likely to eat the seeds?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's an Indian economist who unpacked this question. He was asking, why is it that farmers continue to plant cotton in Andhra Pradesh even though the price of cotton goes down? And it's because the money...
And it depletes the soil.
Yeah, destroys the soil. And, you know, the farmers know this. But the only way the moneylenders will give the farmers credit is if they know the collateral, the crop, isn't going to be eaten in an emergency, and you can't eat cotton. So they always push for the farmers to grow cotton.
My guest is Christian Parenti. His book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, is published by Nation Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Much of your book focuses on pastoral and agricultural communities because of their livelihood is directly tied to the land and the vagaries of weather. However, you turn to Rio, which is a major city, in the second half of your book. How are Rio's problems with violence related to climate change?
Well, it's one of the more attenuated arguments in the book, I'll admit, but I think it's a very real link. So in Brazil, in the northeast, the weather has always been semi-arid there, and it is suffering prolonged drought and the same pattern we discussed in Kenya, punctuated by flooding. So the northeast...
But wait, the northeast is where the... Isn't that where the Amazon empties out?
It's a bit north of there, and it's quite dry. And it's a traditional... I mean, it's where most of the migrants to the cities of the south go. Come from. And so now that climate change is pushing people off the land, they end up in these favelas, as they have for other reasons in the past. And without the ability to stay on the land in the face of climate change, without proper adaptation, people go to the favelas. What happens in the favelas for many young people, particularly young men, if there's not enough work, is they get sucked up into these drug gangs and the violence around the drug trade, which is itself linked to the Cold War and the fights then, because the major drug gang in Rio started out as a guerrilla army. And so today in Rio, you have a situation that looks like civil war. The drug gang, the Comando Vermelho, the Red Command, operates like guerrillas. They have the weapons and tactics. The police act like they're military. They use helicopters. The gangs have shot down helicopters. But there's no ideology. It's not really a civil war. It's just an out-of-control, drug-fueled conflict.
But can't we also see it as a class war? Because we're talking about poor people living on the sides of these mountains, mm-hmm. looking down on these beach communities where very wealthy people mm-hmm. live. There has to be a certain amount of resentment on top yeah. of everything else.
Yeah, yeah, it's very much a reaction to class inequality and to poverty.
Especially in Brazil, which had a history of slavery.
Yeah.
Most of these people who are coming from the north, at least partly from former slave.
To some extent. There's also plenty of Portuguese and Italian heritage up there. But there's definitely the geography of Rio is a perfect example of what sociologists talk about as relative deprivation, that the thing that creates crime and revolution and resentment isn't just deprivation, but deprivation relative to what should be, what could be, or what others have. And in Rio, the poor look down on these luxury beaches, and so the sense of grievance is tremendous.
Hasn't happened also farming policies affected the Amazon? A couple of years back, I had a Brazilian environmentalist on the show, and he talked about the fact that Brazil had been hit by its first hurricane. Usually the hurricanes move up the Atlantic and wind up hitting the Caribbean and everything north, but it had gone into the Amazon.
Yeah. I didn't really explore the Amazon, partly because there's such a large literature on it and it's well covered. So I tried to look at areas that hadn't received as much attention. For example, Kyrgyzstan is like a very classic, very, very direct example of how even in an industrialized, relatively industrialized economy, climate change can trigger violence. People might remember that in the spring of 2010, there was suddenly news of Uzbek versus Kyrgyz ethnic conflict in Kyrgyzstan. And the government of Kyrgyzstan called for Russian troops to come help them maintain order. Russia wisely declined. Well, the backstory to that is that Kyrgyzstan gets 90% of its electricity from hydroelectric power, these big old Soviet-built dams. The same drought that's been affecting Afghanistan has reduced the water level in these dams by 50%. The government had to ration power. Then on top of that, more extreme weather, the coldest winter in many, many decades hit. Just as people needed more power, they had less power. Industry had to shut down. Unemployment went up. Then the president decided he wanted to try and privatize the power system. And so to make the asset more attractive, he doubled the power tariffs and with plans to double it again. And that's what triggered people going into the streets, which then devolved into this ethnic clash. So there's many contributing factors, but you can see that one of the key original causalities is this drought and this extreme winter that helped trigger the crisis.
And you end your book on the U.S.-Mexican border referring to illegal immigrants as climate refugees.
Some immigrants to the U.S. are climate refugees. And
I thought it was just the poverty of Mexico that was driving people north.
I think that there's increasingly a climatological element, and it never is simply just climatological. It's always, woven in with the economic thing. So I, interviewed a couple of people and tried to ask, well, how do you say one is a climate refugee? I mean, clearly if sea levels push you out of your home, you're a climate refugee. But that's usually not the case. So one guy I profiled was a fisherman who in Michoacan, his troubles began in the late 90s when there was an El Nino event and the warm water created a toxic algae bloom. But again, because of liberalization of the Mexican economy, he didn't have the old sort of semi-socialist supports from the Mexican Revolution to fall back on. He had only his own means, so he borrowed money. He couldn't pay his debt. He lost his boat. He then migrates north. He finds himself in Las Cruces, New Mexico as a roofer. Then he gets thrown out of the U.S. And when I meet him, he's sitting on the south bank of the Rio Grande looking north saying, I really don't want to get involved in the drug trade here in Juarez, but I don't have enough money for a coyote to get back across the river, and I don't know what I'm going to do. So is that guy a climate refugee or is he an economic refugee? I mean, obviously a little of both. And there are other examples of that.
Well, one of President Obama's campaign promises was the revival of clean technology. Has his administration focused on that ever since it came to power?
No, he has failed to deliver to the extent that he had promised. I mean, there have been a few positive things. He passed an executive order for government agents, federal government agencies, to start programs of clean purchasing, sort of green purchasing, to use the federal spending, not new money, but the money that the government is going to spend on electricity and cars anyway to try and develop ways of nurturing clean technology with that. But that's been a bit delayed. He hasn't been as robust as he could about allowing the EPA to really use its mandate to regulate greenhouse gases, that, in other words, by shutting down coal plants, stopping coal mining. And there's a lot that could be done despite the totally dysfunctional situation in Washington, D.C.
And Al Gore wrote an article for Rolling Stone just the other day in which he criticized the president for his lack of progress on climate change.
Yeah. And, yeah, I mean, Obama...
Can he get anything done in the current impasse in Washington?
I think he can. And it's in particular, it's the two things I just mentioned. The EPA has the power to really start shutting down dirty smokestacks. And the Obama administration has been delaying on the issuing of these point source review rules. The other thing is this clean purchasing.
But there are people in Congress who want to get rid of the EPA altogether.
And that's part of why Obama has been hesitant to allow the EPA to do what it is mandated to do. But the other key thing is getting very serious about this clean technology purchasing by the government, because that would do two things. One, it would directly reduce carbon emissions by making the federal government cleaner. And it has the largest energy consumer in the U.S. economy, has the largest fleet of vehicles, largest fleet of buildings. But indirectly, it would also have positive effects because it would help create economies of scale in clean technology sectors, and that would help lower the prices of electricity from wind power and solar power, electric vehicles, the batteries that go with them. And once those technologies and clean power are as inexpensive as dirty coal, then the private sector will endorse them without any new spending, without special programs. And the other thing that he really must do is stop these subsidies to fossil fuel industries, which get lots and lots of subsidies. And then, I mean, the big failure of the Obama administration has been also internationally, not really taking a leadership role during Copenhagen, and it doesn't look like they're going to take a really robust leadership role in Durban, where the next round of these climate negotiations are going to happen.
One of your previous books was on Iraq. Mm-hmm. Just for a moment, what are your thoughts about withdrawing forces from Iraq?
I think that Iraq, it was never as the Iraqi government is not simply a pawn of the U.S. and that if to the extent that U.S. troops are going to stay, which they probably will, it's probably because the Iraqi government wants those assets because there is still a low-level civil war going on there.
Even between the two top political leaders. Mm-hmm. There was a photograph of them in the Times, I think, just the other day. Like they wanted to be miles away from each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for being with us. Christian Parenti's latest book is Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. It's published by Nation Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you.